Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4th of July sale and get 30% off paints and stains June 26th through July 6th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only, some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
On the morning of April 2nd, 2025, hundreds of students gathered at a stadium in Frisco, Texas for the District 11 5A Track and Field Championship. Athletes from multiple high schools filled the stadium. Some prepared for upcoming events. Others sat in the bleachers with teammates beneath school tents that were put up around the track. Coaches moved between athletes, and parents watched from the stands. It should have been an ordinary high school track meet. But instead, one brief confrontation would change countless lives forever and become the center of a case that would capture national attention. Around 10 a.m., what started as a disagreement in one of the school tents quickly turned into a physical confrontation between two boys from opposing schools, 17-year-old Austin Metcalf and 17-year-old Carmelo Anthony. The entire encounter lasted only minutes. One moment, students were talking with friends and waiting for their next event. The next, there was a scuffle, and Carmelo Anthony was seen fleeing the tent while Austin Metcalf was left clutching his chest. According to witnesses, Austin lifted his shirt, looked down, and realized he had been stabbed. As panic spread through the tent, Austin stumbled down several rows of bleachers and collapsed. Students scattered in every direction. Some ran for help. Others stood frozen, trying to process what they had just witnessed. Austin's twin brother, Hunter, rushed to his side. Body camera footage would later capture the heartbreaking moments that followed. Hunter can be heard crying, praying, and begging first responders to save his brother, the person he would later describe as his best friend. Around them, coaches, students, bystanders, and medics all rushed into action. CPR was attempted. Life-saving measures were performed. But despite every effort, nothing could be done. Hunter, who entered this world just 4 minutes after Austin, later said that he held his brother in those final moments and watched as his soul left his body. In that instant, he said his own soul left him too. Austin Metcalf was gone. He was only 17 years old. The death of any teenager would have been a tragedy under any circumstances. But what happened after Austin's death quickly became much bigger than a local homicide case. In the hours and days that followed, word spread quickly about what had happened. Social media users began dissecting every detail of the case. Rumors spread faster than verified facts. Claims were shared, reposted, and repeated millions of times. Strangers who had never even set foot in Frisco, Texas, chose sides before law enforcement had even finished their investigation. As the case gained national attention, both families found themselves at the center of an online firestorm. False information circulated widely, and personal information, including their addresses, were shared online. Reports of harassment and swatting incidents followed. Public figures and celebrities even weighed in. Before long, millions of people all over the country were arguing about what happened under that tent. But underneath all the headlines, all the rumors, and all the opinions, the question was actually pretty simple. What did happen under that tent on April 2nd, 2025? Because when this case finally made its way into a courtroom, the jury wasn't there to decide who won the argument online. They were there to decide what the evidence showed. One teenager was dead, another was facing life in prison, and a jury was left to answer the question at the heart of this case. Was this murder or was it self-defense? This is the 13th Juror Podcast, where we explore the trials, investigations, and true crime stories that everyone is talking about. From high-profile trials to the crimes that still leave questions unanswered, we break down the facts, the evidence, and the arguments shaping each story. I'm your host, Brandi Churchwell. Today's episode is Texas versus Carmelo Anthony. We are going to get into some of the detail about the chaos that erupted around this case and the families involved. But before we can evaluate that, we need to go back to the beginning. And to understand what happened that morning, you first have to understand the tense. The track and field district championship meet was being held in Frisco, Texas, a suburb about 30 miles north of Dallas. Athletes from 8 different high schools had gathered to compete, and most of the schools had their own tents set up in the bleachers. Now, these weren't anything fancy. They were the pop-up canopy tents that you'd expect to see at any track meet. But according to the people who spent their lives around the sport, those tents served an important purpose. Rob Starr, the head track coach at Memorial High School, later testified that the tents essentially acted as a home base for each team. Athletes kept their bags, phones, wallets, and other belongings there. Coaches met with athletes there between events, and it was where the team members gathered throughout the day. Starr compared it to a bench area in football or basketball, and according to multiple witnesses, there was an unspoken rule in track and field. You don't hang out under another school's tent. In fact, it's actually district policy instructed that students stay under their own team's tent. A trainer later compared the tents to locker rooms, explaining that while it did happen occasionally, it wasn't normal for athletes to spend time under another school's tent. That detail may seem minor, but it would become central to everything that happened next. Coach Starr knew that his school, Memorial High School, was hosting the championship meet that day. He also knew he would be busy helping run the event. So that morning, before the competition began, he sent a text message to one of his athletes, Austin Metcalf. Austin was 17 years old and a junior at Memorial High School. He worked part-time at a local pizzeria alongside his mother and his twin brother, Hunter. He played football, he ran track, and according to those who knew him, he was the kind of student athlete that others looked up to. So, that morning, Starr asked Austin to step up and be a leader and help out with the day. And Austin agreed. He told his coach, "Yeah, I got you." Austin and Hunter arrived at the meet together and settled beneath Memorial High School's team tent. Then, just before 10 a.m. that morning, another student athlete approached. His name was Carmelo Anthony. Like Austin, Carmelo was 17 years old. And like Austin, he played football, ran track, and worked part-time after school. But Carmelo wasn't a Memorial High School student. He attended Centennial High School. And according to witness testimony, he was the only Centennial athlete under Memorial's tent. According to one witness, Carmelo walked over and took a seat beneath the Memorial High School tent. He reportedly commented on the weather, which at that point had become dark and cloudy, and it looked like rain was either on the way or had already started. But the students under that tent didn't know him. They weren't teammates, and they didn't understand why he was there. Witnesses later said they asked him to leave, but he refused. According to the arrest report, Austin eventually approached Carmelo and told him that he needed to move from under the Memorial tent. What happened over the next few moments would become the central focus of the investigation, the trial, and a national debate that continues to this day. According to witness statements, Carmelo grabbed his book bag that he was carrying, opened it, and reached inside. While keeping one hand in the bag, witnesses said that he looked at Austin and said, "Touch me and see what happens." The students who witnessed the exchange would later tell police that they didn't believe that Carmelo actually had a weapon. I mean, after all, weapons were prohibited on school property and at school events. To them, it sounded more like a threat or an attempt to intimidate. But the confrontation didn't end there. According to the arrest report, Austin stepped toward Carmelo and shoved him, telling him that he needed to leave the tent. And within seconds, everything changed. According to witnesses, after Austin shoved him, Carmelo pulled a folding knife from his bag, and before many of the students standing nearby even had time to process what was happening, he plunged it into Austin Metcalf's chest. The entire encounter was over almost as quickly as it had begun. Witnesses told investigators that Carmelo immediately turned and ran from the tent, tossing the knife as he went. At first, some students didn't fully understand what had happened. I mean, just moments earlier, students had been preparing for races and field events, and now they were watching adults and first responders fight to save a classmate's life. Across the field, Memorial track coach Rob Starr was near the concession stand when he noticed the commotion beneath his team's tent. He knew something was wrong. He immediately started running. When Starr reached the tent, he found Austin lying on the ground. During his testimony, Starr became emotional as he described what he saw. He sobbed on the stand as he told jurors that Austin's face had turned purple and that there was a large hole in his chest. The coach later testified that he knelt beside Hunter and began to pray. As rain began to fall heavily over the stadium, the two remained there together. But Starr told the jury that, in his heart, he already knew Austin wasn't going to survive. Body camera footage from responding officers captured the heartbreaking moments that followed. All around him, medics, coaches, and bystanders did everything they could. CPR was attempted. Life-saving measures continued. But the wound was too severe. Hunter Metcalf, his twin brother and best friend, held Austin in his arms as life slipped away. For 17 years, they had shared nearly every moment together. On that April morning, Hunter was forced to say goodbye. Austin Metcalf died that day. He was 17 years old.
We'll be right back.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
As chaos unfolded beneath the memorial tent, Carmelo Anthony was already moving away from the scene. Surveillance video shows him running from the tent and heading toward an exit. But after putting some distance between himself and the chaos, he kind of slowed down. At times, he appeared to walk alongside groups of students who were leaving the area, blending into the crowd as confusion spread across the stadium. Just minutes after the stabbing, word began crackling over police radios. A student had been stabbed. Officers rushed toward the track as descriptions of a possible suspect were relayed across the scene. Before long, they spotted a teenager matching that description walking toward the exit of the stadium. As officers approached and told him to keep his hands visible, Carmelo immediately began talking, telling the officer, quote, "He put his hands on me."
All right. "He put his hands on me. I told him not to. He put his hands on me."
The officers detained him and escorted him away from the track. But then, as one officer explained to another that they had detained the alleged suspect, Carmelo interrupted, correcting them. He said, "I'm not alleged. I did it." As officers walked him toward the patrol vehicle, they noticed what appeared to be fresh blood on one of his fingers and photographed it as evidence. Back at the stadium, the focus shifted to finding the weapon. Witnesses told investigators that they had seen a knife thrown toward the bleachers after the stabbing. Students and officers searched the area until someone remembered exactly where it had landed. There, wedged between rows of bleachers, investigators found a folding knife laying partially open. By then, the weather that the students had been talking about all morning had finally arrived. Rain began pouring onto the stadium. Investigators worked quickly, photographing the knife and surrounding area before the downpour could wash away potential evidence. They covered the knife with a tarp to protect it from the elements and weighed the tarp down with a nearby backpack. Only later would they realize that the backpack belonged to Carmelo Anthony. Within a matter of hours, investigators had a suspect in custody, the alleged murder weapon had been recovered, and detectives had begun the painstaking process of interviewing the students who had witnessed what happened beneath the memorial tent. And y'all, there was no shortage of witnesses. The tent had been crowded that morning. Some students were sitting underneath it, others were standing nearby, several were only a few feet away when the confrontation began. And while no two people noticed every single detail exactly the same way, many of their accounts told remarkably similar stories about what happened in those brief but devastating moments. In the days that followed, the case moved quickly. Carmelo Anthony was taken to the Collin County Jail and charged with first-degree felony murder in connection with Austin Metcalf's death. A judge set his bond at $1 million, and for the moment, he remained behind bars. While Carmelo sat in jail awaiting his next court appearance, Austin's family was preparing for something that no parent should ever have to do. They laid their son to rest. At Austin's memorial service, family members and friends remembered him as a kind-hearted teenager who loved sports, loved the outdoors, and rarely met a stranger. Teammates remembered his competitive spirit. Loved ones spoke about his loyalty to family and friends. Again and again, people described a young man whose life had touched far more people than anyone had realized until he was gone. For the Metcalf family, the focus was on grief. But in the courtroom, attention was already shifting to what would happen next for Carmelo Anthony. Just 2 days after Austin's memorial service, Carmelo was back before a judge asking for a reduction in his bond. His attorney argued that the $1 million bond was excessive. Prosecutors disagreed. They pointed to the seriousness of the charge and argued that a crowdfunding campaign created on Carmelo's behalf had already raised hundreds of thousands of dollars. If supporters had contributed that much money, prosecutors argued, then the family had the resources to post bond. But Carmelo's father testified that the family did not have access to those funds. He told the court that he was the sole provider for his wife and 4 children, and that the intense attention surrounding the case had forced the family to move. Between relocation expenses and supporting his family, he said they simply could not afford the original bond amount. After hearing the arguments, the judge reduced Carmelo's bond from $1 million to $250,000. The judge also imposed a series of strict conditions. If released, Carmelo would be required to wear an ankle monitor, remain at home unless granted permission to leave, stay off social media, and avoid contact with classmates. In explaining her decision, the judge noted that bond is not intended to punish a defendant before trial. She said that she had considered Carmelo's age, his lack of criminal history, his ties to the community, and other factors required under Texas law. But she also took a moment to address Austin's family directly. She said, "There's no replacement for the loss of life or the loss of a child." She said she didn't want the family to think that a bond amount is connected to the dignity of loss, because you cannot make the person come back. A short time later, Carmelo Anthony walked out of the Collin County Jail. By then, an online fundraiser supporting his legal defense had raised more than $400,000. Supporters argued that he had acted in self-defense and deserved the chance to fight the charges from home. Critics saw something very different, because to them, a teenager was dead and the person accused of killing him was now free pending trial. That divide that had already begun forming online only grew wider, and before long, the case would become about far more than what happened under a tent at a high school track meet.
We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Almost from the moment the stabbing happened, two very different narratives began to emerge. To understand why this case became so controversial, you have to first understand that Carmelo Anthony's claim of self-defense didn't appear months later after attorneys got involved. According to witnesses, it started almost immediately. As students scrambled to help Austin Metcalf, Carmelo was identified by witnesses and stopped before he could leave the stadium. Multiple people who interacted with him that morning described hearing essentially the same thing. He kept saying, "He put his hands on me." One coach testified that Carmelo was emotional and repeatedly said Austin had put his hands on him. Another coach, who stayed with Carmelo while they waited for police, said that Carmelo immediately also told him that Austin had put his hands on him, so he stabbed him. That coach later testified that he told Carmelo something that would prove chilling in hindsight. He said, "If Austin dies, you've just changed your whole life." According to the coach, Carmelo responded, saying, "He's not going to die." The coach said it didn't seem like the reality of the situation had fully registered. As the minutes passed, witnesses described Carmelo becoming increasingly emotional. He was crying, and at one point he hugged one of the coaches. When officers arrived, he continued telling people nearby that he had been protecting himself. Body cam footage captured him crying as police took him into custody. For the defense, this was important because they pointed to the fact that Carmelo never denied stabbing Austin. They argued that from the very beginning, he consistently claimed that he acted because Austin had put his hands on him. But for others, those same facts led to a very different conclusion. Critics pointed out that by Carmelo's own account, the physical contact involved Austin putting his hands on him while trying to remove him from the tent. They questioned whether that justified introducing a knife into the confrontation. To them, the case wasn't about self-defense at all. It was about a disagreement that escalated into unnecessary, deadly violence. And that disagreement quickly spread far beyond Frisco. Within hours of the stabbing, screenshots, rumors, and competing versions of events began flooding social media. Millions of people who had never met Austin Metcalf or Carmelo Anthony suddenly found themselves debating what had happened beneath that tent. The problem was that many people were reaching conclusions long before investigators had finished collecting evidence. Rumors were spreading faster than verified information, and one viral social media post from a relative of Carmelo's described the stabbing as self-defense and claimed that Austin and Hunter had attempted to jump him. The post alleged that they had tried to take Carmelo's belongings, broke his phone, and even stomped on it. Supporters shared that post as evidence that important details were being left out of news coverage. But others pointed out that many of those claims had not been verified by investigators or witnesses. And as the online debate intensified, misinformation became a story of its own. Fake social media accounts appeared pretending to be law enforcement officials. One account impersonated the Frisco police chief and falsely claimed to have inside information about the investigation. At another point, a fabricated medical examiner's report began circulating online. Both were shared thousands of times before being debunked. The situation became so widespread that Frisco police publicly warned people not to rely on social media rumors and urged them to follow only verified sources. The police chief later revealed that the fake account using his name was itself under investigation. But by then, the conversation had already grown beyond the facts of the case. Questions about self-defense became intertwined with debates about race. And to understand why, there's an important detail that I haven't mentioned until now. Austin Metcalf was white. Carmelo Anthony is black. As the story spread beyond Frisco, those facts became part of the public conversation. What had initially been reported as a deadly confrontation between two teenagers was increasingly framed as a case involving a black teen and a white teen. For some people, race had nothing to do with what happened under the tent. They believed that the case should be evaluated solely on the actions of the two individuals involved and the evidence collected by investigators. But others viewed the case through a broader lens, raising questions about race, perception, and how similar cases are discussed in the media and by the public. As a result, conversations about self-defense, criminal responsibility, and the evidence quickly became entangled with larger debates that extended far beyond the events of April 2nd. What started as a local homicide investigation was becoming a national conversation, with people bringing their own experiences, beliefs, and perspectives to the case. Political activists, influencers, and commentators from across the country began inserting themselves into the story. And what had started as a homicide investigation involving two teenagers was becoming a national flashpoint. The attention only intensified after Carmelo's bond was reduced and he was released from jail. Supporters argued that the reduction reflected the legal principle that bond is not meant to be punishment before trial. But critics saw something entirely different, because to them, a 17-year-old was dead, and the person accused of killing him had walked out of jail. Soon, activists and political groups from outside of Texas began arriving in Frisco. One demonstration organized by a group called Protect White People drew national attention. The organization attempted to use Austin's death to advance its own racial and political message. Austin's father publicly rejected those efforts, criticizing anyone who sought to use his son's death to push a racist narrative. The protest ultimately resulted in arrests and further media attention. At the same time, the Anthony family found themselves at the center of a storm that they said was fueled by misinformation. Appearing alongside the Next Generation Action Network, Carmelo's parents held their first public press conference. They described receiving threats, being forced to relocate for safety reasons, and watching false claims about their family spread across the internet. Carmelo's mother disputed allegations that the family had used donated funds to purchase a home and said that they had not received any money from the fundraiser at that time. She said that the lies and false accusations that had been spread about their family had been overwhelming. The event itself quickly became controversial as well. That's because Austin's father unexpectedly arrived and was escorted out. According to him, he had hoped to demonstrate that both families were victims of the tragedy. He hoped to pray together and to show the world that they were united. But Metcalf was criticized during the press conference, with his appearance being labeled a disrespect to the dignity of his son. Yikes. The controversy didn't end there, though. Both families reported harassment. Personal information, including home addresses, were being shared online. There were reports of repeated swatting incidents, where false emergency calls triggered large police responses with armed officers entering your home. Even the judge who reduced Carmelo's bond became a target. Her home address was reportedly shared online, despite protections that exist to shield judges' personal information. But by that point, the case had become about far more than what happened beneath a tent at a high school track meet. It had become a battleground for competing narratives, political agendas, racial tensions, internet misinformation, and deeply held beliefs about self-defense, accountability, and justice. And through all of it, one fact remained unchanged. A 17-year-old was dead. The question was whether Carmelo's actions were a crime or a legally justified act of self-defense. That was the question that a jury would eventually have to answer. We'll be right back.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
The trial was set for June of 2026. By that point, the case had generated months of debate, countless headlines, and more arguments than most homicide cases ever see. But inside the courtroom, the jurors weren't being asked to decide any of that. They were being asked to answer one question. Was the stabbing of Austin Metcalf a crime, or was it legally justified as self-defense? Under Texas law, a person can use force to defend themselves if they reasonably believe it is immediately necessary to protect themselves from another person's use of force. Now, in some situations, that can even include deadly force. But the law doesn't simply ask whether someone was scared or if a person genuinely believed they were in danger. The law asks whether that belief was reasonable under the circumstances and whether the level of force used was justified. And that distinction became the entire case. The prosecution argued that what happened under the memorial tent was murder. They claimed Carmelo Anthony had his knife ready before Austin ever approached him, and that the stabbing was not a defensive act, but an offensive act. According to prosecutors, the knife wasn't used to protect Carmelo from harm. It was used to inflict harm on someone else. They argued that even if Austin shoved Carmelo, a shove is not the kind of force that justifies responding with deadly force. And prosecutors pointed to what happened afterward as well. If Carmelo was truly scared and acting in self-defense, why throw the knife into the bleachers and run away? But the defense saw it differently. According to them, Carmelo wasn't looking for a confrontation at all. They argued that he sat beneath the memorial tent simply because it was raining and he was trying to get out of the weather. They also pointed to what they described as a significant size difference between the two teenagers. Austin was listed on Max Preps as 6 feet tall and 200 pounds. Carmelo was listed as 5'11" and 162 pounds, a difference of nearly 40 pounds. Jail records, however, listed Carmelo at 5'9", creating an even larger potential height difference. Either way, the defense argued that Carmelo was smaller than Austin, and that the size disparity contributed to his fear during the confrontation. The defense also disputed the prosecution's version of what happened beneath the tent. According to the defense, Austin didn't simply shove Carmelo. They claimed that he grabbed him, punched him, and pushed him. They also argued that Austin's twin brother, Hunter, joined the confrontation, leaving Carmelo feeling outnumbered and trapped. Now, in the defense's telling, this wasn't a teenager overreacting to a minor disagreement. It was a teenager who suddenly found himself facing multiple people, believed he was in danger, and had only seconds to decide how to respond. Because of that, they argued, the stabbing was an act of self-defense, not murder. And that's what the jury ultimately had to sort through. Not the social media rumors, not the political arguments, not the public outrage. Their job was to determine whether the state had proven, beyond a reasonable doubt, that Carmelo Anthony's actions were not justified under Texas law. The state had to convince the jury that Carmelo's use of deadly force was unlawful. Everything that happened during the trial, from the witness testimony to the surveillance video to the physical evidence, would be aimed at answering that one question. When the trial finally began in June of 2026, hundreds of potential jurors were called in. After days of questioning, 12 jurors and 6 alternates were selected to decide one of the most closely watched cases in the country. The attention surrounding the trial was impossible to ignore. Because of the intense public interest, the judge prohibited cameras, photography, and any type of broadcasting from inside the courtroom. Only a handful of credentialed journalists were allowed inside each day, meaning much of what happened during the trial reached the public through reporters' notes rather than video footage. Now, inside the courtroom, the judge worked to keep the proceedings orderly and focused on the evidence. But outside, y'all, it was a different story. Supporters and protesters gathered throughout the trial, and on some days, members of activist group appeared outside the courthouse. On others, political organizations showed up. Supporters of Carmelo carried signs calling for his release, while others gathered in support of Austin and his family. The trial had become far more than a local criminal case. But once the testimony began, all of that noise faded into the background for jurors. The prosecution's first witness was a forensic video analyst. Jurors watched as a large screen was wheeled into the courtroom and surveillance footage from the track meet was played frame by frame. Now, the video had been captured by a stationary camera on the opposite side of the football field, and it wasn't very close, it wasn't very clear. In fact, it was actually so grainy that individual facial expressions and many of the details, of course, were impossible to make out. But it did capture the timeline. Jurors watched as Carmelo approached the memorial tent and sat down, and then they watched as Austin moved toward Carmelo beneath the tent. They watched the confrontation unfold. And then they watched Carmelo run away from the area immediately afterward, heading toward an exit before eventually slowing down and kind of blending into the crowd. Now, the footage also captured the aftermath. So jurors saw students rush toward Austin, and they saw the desperate efforts to save him. They saw Hunter Metcalf on body cam refusing to leave his brother's side. In total, prosecutors said that the video showed that Austin and Carmelo were together beneath that tent for only about 4 minutes before the stabbing occurred. But the prosecution wasn't showing the video just to establish a timeline. They believed it supported one of the most important parts of this case. The defense had argued that Carmelo was being ganged up on and feared for his safety. But prosecutors argued that the video showed something very different. While the footage was grainy, they maintained that it showed only Austin moving toward Carmelo before the stabbing, not a group ganging up on him. But still, prosecutors knew that the surveillance footage could only tell jurors so much. The camera was too far away to capture the words being exchanged. So for that, they needed the people who had actually been there. So one by one, students began taking the witness stand. And as the testimony unfolded, a pattern began to emerge. Witness after witness described Carmelo being asked to leave the memorial tent. One student testified that the atmosphere became increasingly tense as Carmelo continued refusing to leave. According to that witness, Austin wasn't the only person asking him to go. Multiple students wanted him out from under the tent. The witness estimated that Carmelo was asked to leave around 15 times. But even then, the student told jurors he never imagined that anyone would get seriously hurt. At most, he expected that maybe there was going to be some pushing. Another witness described the confrontation growing more heated as the back and forth continued, and several students actually recalled hearing Carmelo make statements like, "Touch me and see what happens." And multiple witnesses testified that Carmelo appeared to be provoking Austin rather than trying to de-escalate the situation. One student remembered Austin responding, "I'm not going to fight you at a track meet, dude." A student from a neighboring high school whose team tent was nearby testified that she heard Carmelo tell Austin, "If you want me to move, you're going to have to move me." She could tell the confrontation was heading toward a physical altercation, but even then, she said she didn't expect what would happen next. And that became one of the recurring themes throughout the prosecution's case. No one seemed to know that a knife was involved. No one expected a stabbing. Over and over, witnesses described anticipating an argument, maybe a shove, perhaps even a brief fight. But what they didn't expect was deadly violence. One witness testified that after Austin shoved Carmelo, the stabbing happened almost instantly, as though it was like all part of the same motion. And at one point, an attorney asked whether Austin had grabbed hold of Carmelo, and the witness answered he didn't even get the chance to grab hold of him. He had already been stabbed. By the time the prosecution finished presenting its eyewitness testimony, jurors had heard from student after student who described remarkably similar events. According to those witnesses, Carmelo refused repeated requests to leave the tent. He challenged students who confronted him, escalated the tension beneath the tent, and then stabbed Austin almost immediately after Austin attempted to physically remove him. Taken together, the prosecution argued those witnesses told a story that looked nothing like self-defense.
We'll be right back.
Yo, it's Jey Uso from WWE,
and I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win.
Let's Chumba. Yeah.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
When the prosecution rested its case, the defense finally had its opportunity to tell the story of what they believe happened. But one thing had become apparent as the trial unfolded. The defense was facing an uphill battle. Over the course of several days, jurors had heard witness after witness describe this one version of events that largely supported the prosecution's theory. And while there were differences in what people remembered, many of the students told remarkably similar stories. And perhaps most importantly for the defense, reporters covering the trial noted that there didn't appear to be any eyewitnesses who fully supported the defense's claim that Carmelo had been attacked by multiple people or was being ganged up on when the stabbing occurred. So instead of presenting a dramatically different version of events, the defense focused on providing context for why Carmelo may have perceived the situation differently than the witnesses around him. One of the witnesses they called was a coach from Carmelo's school. The coach testified that at his school, students generally weren't asked to leave another school's tent simply because they attended a different school. The implication here was that if that was the environment that Carmelo was used to, he may not have viewed sitting under the memorial tent as inappropriate or confrontational in the first place. The defense also called several students who interacted with Carmelo in the moments after the stabbing. Rather than focusing on what happened before Austin was stabbed, much of their testimony focused on Carmelo's behavior afterward. Like, witnesses described him as emotional and distraught and crying. Several recalled him repeatedly saying that he had acted to protect himself. And one witness testified that Carmelo had told Austin words to the effect of, "As long as you don't touch me, there won't be any problems." Now, for the defense, those statements were important, because they argued that Carmelo's immediate reaction was consistent with someone who believed he had acted in self-defense, rather than someone who had intentionally committed murder. But as the defense case moved forward, many observers continued waiting for what they thought might be the most important witness of all, and that is Carmelo Anthony himself. Now, in self-defense cases, it's not uncommon for a defendant to take the stand. While every defendant has an absolute constitutional right not to testify, jurors often want to understand what was going through a person's mind when they made the decision to use deadly force. What did they see? What were they afraid of? Why did they believe they needed to act? Those questions can be difficult to answer without hearing directly from the person claiming self-defense. And because of that, many people expected that Carmelo might testify. But when the time came, his attorneys announced that he would not be taking the stand. Jurors would never hear his version of events directly from him. And with that, the defense rested its case. The evidence was in, the witnesses were finished, and the trial was now headed toward the moment both families had been waiting for, the closing arguments. First up was the defense. Defense attorney Mike Howard returned to the same theme that had guided the defense from the beginning. He said this case was about self-defense. He reminded jurors that Austin Metcalf had every right to ask Carmelo Anthony to leave the tent. But according to the defense, asking someone to leave and physically forcing them to leave were two very different things. He said the government wants to make this case about how Carmelo could have just left. But Howard told the jury, "Look, I'm sure he wishes he did. We all do." But Howard argued that that wasn't the question that jurors were here to answer. The question, he said, was what happened when the confrontation became physical. He argued that Carmelo had an absolute right to defend himself, and if you wait until it's too late to defend yourself, it's meaningless. Howard also challenged jurors to look critically at the testimony that they had heard. Many of the witnesses were Austin's friends and teammates, he noted, and they were trying to recall an event that unfolded in just seconds. He also returned to the defense's argument that Carmelo was the smaller of the two teenagers. And he asked, why would Carmelo pick a fight with a kid that's bigger than him? The defense maintained that there was no prior conflict between the two boys. They had never met before, and there was no feud, no history, and no apparent reason for Carmelo to just attack a complete stranger. Howard also addressed the controversy that had surrounded the case from the beginning. He told jurors, it's not about race, as much as people on the outside want to make it about that one way or the other. Instead, he asked jurors to put themselves in Carmelo's position. Austin is standing. Carmelo is seated. Austin is angry. Carmelo tells him not to touch him. Even placing his hand in his bag, Howard suggested, wasn't a threat. It was a warning. And as he closed, Howard acknowledged something that had lingered throughout the trial. No one truly knows everything that happened beneath that tent. The witnesses provided pieces of the story, and the surveillance video showed part of it. But according to the defense, there were still unanswered questions about those final seconds before Austin was stabbed. And if those questions created reasonable doubt, Howard said the law required only one verdict. Then it was the prosecution's turn. The assistant district attorney stood before the jury and argued that despite everything they had heard over the previous days, this case came down to a few simple facts. Carmelo Anthony brought a knife to a high school track meet. He was asked to leave the memorial tent, and he refused. And when Austin Metcalf finally put his hands on him, Carmelo pulled out that knife and drove it into Austin's chest. Prosecutors told jurors that the defense wanted them to focus on motive, like why Carmelo would attack someone he had never met, or why he would pick a fight with a larger teenager. But according to the prosecution, they were asking the wrong question, because what's important is not motive, it's mindset. In the prosecutor's view, Carmelo's mindset was revealed by one fact that separated him from everyone else under that tent. He's the one who had a knife. Austin didn't know it. The other students didn't know it. But Carmelo did. And according to the prosecution, that knowledge changed everything. Prosecutors argued that Carmelo always knew he possessed the ability to instantly escalate any confrontation from a verbal disagreement into deadly violence. Prosecutors said he had a secret because he had a knife. Prosecutors then turned to one of the central themes of the defense's case, that Austin was the one who became physical first. Even if that were true, self-defense still did not apply. That's because, according to the prosecution, Carmelo had multiple opportunities to walk away, and he chose not to. He could have left when students first asked him to leave. He could have left when the confrontation became heated. He could have left before Austin ever approached him. But he didn't. He did not abandon the encounter. Now, under Texas law, prosecutors said that a person cannot provoke a confrontation and then immediately claim self-defense when the situation turns physical. You don't get to provoke an encounter and, as soon as someone touches you, use deadly force, he told the jury. He then addressed what may have been the prosecution's strongest argument of all. Even if jurors believe that Austin shoved Carmelo, even if they believe that Austin was angry, even if they believe that Austin initiated the physical contact, all of that could be true, but the response still had to be proportional. You can meet force with force, like a shove with a shove, but according to the prosecution, that's not what happened here. Austin used his hands. Carmelo instantly used a knife, and those two things were not remotely equivalent. You can't meet a force, like a shove, with deadly force. It has to be proportional. As the prosecutor neared the end of his argument, he asked jurors to consider what a reasonable person would have done in that moment. Not what Carmelo claims he feared, not what social media believed, and not what commentators outside of the courthouse were saying, but what would an ordinary, reasonable person have done? Would a reasonable person have believed they were facing a threat so serious that the only option was to pull out a knife and stab an unarmed teenager in the chest? And the prosecution's answer was no. And with that, prosecutors delivered the argument that sat at the heart of the state's entire case. Carmelo had a secret. He had a knife, so no matter what, he was going to come out on top. This wasn't self-defense, the prosecution argued. It was murder, plain and simple.
We'll be right back.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
With closing arguments complete, the case was finally in the jury's hands. Now, before deliberations began, there was one final legal battle. The defense had asked the judge to allow jurors to consider lesser charges if they did not believe that Carmelo Anthony was guilty of murder. Now, one option was manslaughter, which in simple terms means causing someone's death through reckless actions rather than intentionally committing murder. The other was criminally negligent homicide, which applies when a person's careless behavior leads to a death that they should have recognized could happen. Now, the judge agreed, meaning jurors would have three possible paths: murder, manslaughter, or criminally negligent homicide. And they could also acquit Carmelo entirely if they believed that he acted in lawful self-defense. So as jurors disappeared behind closed doors, tension outside the courthouse continued to build. Supporters and protesters waited for answers. Families waited. Reporters waited. And then, after just 3 hours of deliberation, the jury had a verdict. The courtroom fell silent as they announced the decision. Carmelo Anthony was guilty of murder. That verdict carried an important meaning. It meant that the jury did not accept his claim of self-defense. They concluded that Carmelo's use of deadly force was not legally justified under Texas law. After days of testimony and months of public debate, the jurors had answered the central question of this case. This was not self-defense, it was murder. The sentencing guidelines for murder in Texas are between 5 to 99 years. Now, prosecutors argued that Austin Metcalf's death deserved a significant sentence. The defense, meanwhile, asked jurors to remember that Carmelo was still a teenager with no prior criminal history, and that the decision that brought him into the courtroom had been made in a matter of seconds. In the end, Carmelo was sentenced to 35 years in prison. Now, under Texas law, he will be eligible for parole after serving half of that sentence. Half of that sentence is 17 and a half years. which is ironic because the amount of time that Carmelo Anthony may spend in prison is the same amount of time that Austin Metcalf spent on this earth. For Austin Metcalf's family, the verdict and sentence brought a measure of closure, at least for this chapter. But for Carmelo Anthony and his family, the legal fight was far from over. Almost immediately, his attorneys announced their intention to appeal. Now, an appeal is not a new trial. Appellate courts do not decide whether a defendant is guilty or innocent. Instead, they review the trial itself, looking for legal errors that may have affected the outcome. Carmelo assembled a new legal team to handle that process. Several attorneys agreed to take on the appeal pro bono, meaning they would represent him without charging legal fees. The new defense team has indicated that they intend to challenge multiple aspects of the trial, including issues surrounding jury selection and other rulings made before and during the proceedings. As of this recording, the appeal process is still ongoing. Cases like this often leave people searching for a lesson. Maybe it's about carrying a weapon. Maybe it's about anger. Maybe it's about pride. Maybe it's about the choices we make in the few seconds that can change the rest of our lives. The truth is, this case has meant different things to different people. Some will always believe that Carmelo Anthony acted in self-defense. Others will always believe the evidence showed a clear and unjustified murder. And because an appeal is still pending, the legal debate isn't over yet. But beyond the arguments, beyond the headlines, beyond the politics, the social media posts, and the controversy, there are two realities that no court ruling can change. Austin Metcalf never got to go home. A 17-year-old boy who woke up expecting to compete at a track meet instead lost his life beneath a school tent. His family lost a son. Hunter lost his twin brother. And an entire community was left trying to make sense of a tragedy that unfolded in less than a minute. And at the same time, another 17-year-old boy made a decision that altered the course of his own life forever. Whatever side of the case someone falls on, that's the part that's the hardest to ignore. Two teenagers arrived at the same track meet that morning. One left in an ambulance, the other left in handcuffs. And nearly everything that followed, the trial, the protests, the fundraisers, the media attention, the arguments about race and self-defense, can all be traced back to a confrontation that lasted only seconds. For the jurors, the question was whether those seconds amounted to self-defense or murder, and they answered that question. But the larger questions, the one about how conflicts escalate, how quickly lives can change, and whether any of this could have been prevented, are questions that don't come with verdict forms. They are questions that remain long after the courtroom empties. And long after the case is closed. My name is Brandi Churchwell, creator and host of the 13th Juror podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to follow the show on your favorite podcast platform and leave a rating or review. It helps more listeners discover the podcast. And if you know someone who would find this case as fascinating as you did, share this episode with them. For additional episodes, case updates, and more information about the podcast, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com. The evidence has been presented, the arguments have been made, and now comes the same question faced by every juror. What do you believe? Thank you for listening.
Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what it feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boosts and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.